This is The Record, and welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. Changes are coming to Miss America. No more swimsuits, no more judging on appearances. We're going to ask two former Miss Washingtons what they think of that change a little bit later on the show today. But first, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin says there's no chance of a redo in the search for Seattle's police chief. That means the interim police chief, Carmen Best, will remain eliminated from the top three finalists for the job. So now that we're down to three, we want to ask you, what do you want from your next police chief? Where do you see problems? Where do you see success? Tell us a story about it when you give us a call at 206-543-5869, 543-5869. 5869. And we have a panel to talk about what they're looking for. Enrique Gonzalez co-chairs the Community Police Commission. He's a member of the Police Chief Search Committee. Tara Moss is project director at Seattle King County's Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program. And State Representative Morgan Irwin is also a Seattle police officer, though he's not speaking on behalf of the police department today, just as an officer and a lawmaker. Welcome to everybody. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enrique, you were on the initial search committee that narrowed the choices to five. What is the most important qualification for Seattle police chief, in your view?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. Yes, I was on that search committee, and I can tell you from experience and from folks that we've been talking to in the community that the idea that an internal candidate is not somebody who we're looking for is simply not true. It's not necessarily true that we only want an outside candidate. We're looking for somebody who the community can build trust and have a relationship with. And the fact of the matter is that the search committee that has done a lot of the work leading up to this point has not trusted the entire process because we've arrived at a place that does not correspond with the community need. And so we need a different process that's going to acknowledge what people are looking for in a chief, and that is somebody who they can develop a relationship with, somebody who they can trust, and somebody who is going to respond to the needs of the people in a very real and human way.
Enrique, you said we don't necessarily need an outsider, but a letter from the four police chief search committee co-chairs to the mayor at the end of May said, quote, "Our personal observations reinforce what the Department of Justice found in their investigation, a police department with a lack of effective leadership and a culture that tolerated that deficiency." That's a strong statement, and it seems to point to a need for an outsider. Do you agree with that statement?
Well, with all due respect to the co-chairs of the search committee, they're not speaking on behalf of the entire committee, because I can tell you that the City of Seattle's Police Department has also reached full and effective compliance when it comes to the consent decree. And if that is true, then that means that the department has moved significantly from where it was 7 years ago.
Enrique, I just want to tell the listeners who are following along that this consent decree means that a few years ago, the U.S. Justice Department found evidence of excessive force and biased policing in the Seattle Department. And in January, a federal judge found that the police department is in compliance with the reforms that the Justice Department wanted to see. So go on.
That's correct. So if we're to assume that the federal monitor and the Justice Department are saying that we're in a full and effective compliance, that would indicate to some degree that an internal candidate could potentially leave the department because it's at a place where we can now assume that that is something viable. So for us to say that an outside candidate is what is needed, the search committee had a discussion very candidly about whether or not an internal or an external candidate is needed, and we simply did not arrive at a conclusion one way or the other. But to say that we need an external candidate is just not true. We did not arrive at that conclusion.
And the most prominent inside candidate, obviously, is the woman who's been doing the job. She's the interim chief, Carmen Best, who, as we said, is not one of the final three as Seattle chooses its new police chief. Tara, you work with several groups, including police officers, case managers, businesses, community members. What is your number one priority for the next police chief?
Well, I have to agree with Enrique about listening to the community. But what is interesting about my job is I work with all aspects of the community, from case management and outreach workers and people who are concerned about the individuals who have the most contact with police, to community members who feel like they are calling the police and they want a certain result. And I will give you an example where that listening to the community is important and having a relationship with that community is important, because sometimes you have to tell someone no, or what you're asking for is not the right thing.
Yeah, what is an example?
Sure. I was at a community public safety meeting, and there was a lieutenant there, and community members were talking about how they need car problems addressed more aggressively, and were asking if increased police officers would fix that problem. And the lieutenant said, honestly, no. And he didn't, we didn't plan for me to be in the room representing LEAD, but he said a program like LEAD would really address.
This is law enforcement assisted diversion, trying to keep low-level offenders out of jail and in community programs.
Exactly. And he addressed this community group who has a lot of access to things like night meetings and has a lot of access to their representatives. And he said, what we need is different programs that do long-term results that may be slower, but you'll get the better outcome. It would have been much easier for him to tell that community group, you know what, more officers will make a difference. And he didn't do that. And that's an example of that relationship. And I think that that kind of transparent discussion is an example, an environment the police department has set from the chief on down to allow these officers to have more candid conversations with people. And that community relationship allows that.
And we have a Seattle police officer with us who's also a state representative, Morgan Irwin, representing Enumclaw as a Republican. What's your reaction to that long-term results versus more officers not necessarily being the answer?
Sure. And I think that you just demoted Captain.
Lieutenant at the time.
Oh,
thank
Lieutenant
you for checking me.
Lieutenant, now Captain Grossman, who's the captain of the South Precinct, and doing a great job. Just to get it out of the way, my views are my own. I don't represent the city or the police department in any way. In terms of what we can do as a community, if we're working towards diverting people out of traditional criminal justice pathways, if we can provide people with the ability to be in society, then we can reduce a lot of the crime that we see out there. And one of the things...
What does that mean, ability to be in society?
So Michael Jackson, who runs Auburn Youth Family Care, I think it's Nexus Care now, one of his lines, and it's a great line, is when we talk about rehabilitation, many of the people we're trying to rehabilitate have never been habilitated. You know, they've never been a functioning part of society where they're, you know, have a job and are renting an apartment or buying a house and raising a family. No, that's never been them. And so if we can put people in situations like a diversion center where they're getting mental health treatment, addiction services treatment, job training, you know, kind of those skills, not to rehabilitate, but just to habilitate somebody. That's always been big. It goes a little beyond what we're dealing with the chief search today.
Yes.
But that's one of those models that we've pushed for here in Seattle for a very long time now.
What is your top priority, Representative, for a Seattle police chief? For a police chief, you live in Enumclaw, but you're an officer in the Seattle Police Department.
Sure. And if we were looking for a new chief at State Patrol, or we were looking for a new police chief in Auburn or Enumclaw, or any of the communities I represent, or Seattle, from an officer's perspective, departments a lot of times get stuck with someone who's more of a consultant. They're coming in for a couple of years, and this is not casting shade on any of the final three candidates, who I believe a couple of them have done consulting work. If you hire a chief who brings in a consultant, that's great. But we need a chief, someone who's going to be stable, who's going to be here for 4 or 5 years. If you're going to be a transformational leader, you can't do that in 20 months or less. That's something that takes time. And when we talk about building trust with community groups, you know, reaching out, using different models, you know, that sort of systematic change, it doesn't happen in less than 36 months. We need a chief. We need a chief.
That echoes what we heard from a KOW listener. I want to play that and then ask you a more specific question about what you mean, Representative. This is a voicemail from a listener of ours.
Hi, my name is Taeyong Nguyen. I'm from the Columbia City of South Seattle. I've lived in my neighborhood for 25 years. I've been a community activist. I also worked with NAACP in the past on excessive use of force to bring U.S. Department of Justice to Seattle. I would like the next police chief to ensure the community that we can have a police captain we can hold accountable, meaning stop rotating them around, that you can put somebody that community can recognize, name, and face, and take time for everybody in the community to get to know this person, and we have somebody we can hold accountable.
Okay, so I want to talk about that. First, I know that Enrique Gonzalez, who is a member of the Police Chief Search Committee, only has a limited amount of time with us. So I'd like to get your reaction to what you've heard, Enrique, and what you want to tell our listeners about the selection of a new Seattle police chief.
Well, absolutely. The caller mentioned accountability, and I think that oftentimes when we think of accountability, it simply means that officers are held liable or somehow looked down upon and looked at what they've done wrong. That's certainly a part of accountability, but I think also accountability means lifting up what is being done right. And there are officers who are doing things right. The problem is that not necessarily the system is providing a space for officers to be held accountable for what they're doing right. And I think that when we think about what it means to have a chief that is going to be held accountable, it also means, are they uplifting the kind of policing that we want to see? There's a lot of talk around the types of officers that we have on the streets. Do they reflect the population that lives in the city? And so I would also urge whoever we're going to be hiring as a chief, are they going to help systemically bring about more officers that look like the communities that they're policing?
Do we have evidence that when a city has a police chief who is a person of color or who is a woman, that city polices differently? What is the evidence of that?
I would say that we have evidence in what is attempted to be done, but the problem is that there are a lot of systemic factors that prevent even the intention to carry itself out into actual real results. And so the way that I would say that is that even if former police chief Kathy O'Toole meant to do things right, the results of it, I think, arguably would be that things are not necessarily better, but it also depends on who you ask.
And but are you saying that has anything to do with Chief O'Toole not having been a person of color? Give me a specific example.
Well, I would say I think that she often would speak of making changes when it comes to the type of officers that we had, but whether it was for a lack of political will or systemic reasons, a lot of the changes that we see are not necessarily felt by community members on the ground.
And if I can riff off that just slightly, when I took the test to become a Seattle police officer, there was 2,500 people in the video test. Like, we filled Kane Hall at UW. And, you know, now we're lucky to get 300 candidates turning out. And when you're trying to have a diverse candidate pool with a shrinking candidate pool, that's tough. And I think...
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, here we are in a situation where... You know, one of Seattle's best and brightest, somebody who absolutely committed themselves to a career for the city of Seattle, who was a transformative leader, who has the respect of community groups, has respect of the rank and file, who's been through some of our most difficult follow-up units. She's risen in Carmen Best up to the top. And I think that there's officers and I think there's people in this region that are saying, you know, in some way, if you ever put on the Seattle police uniform, you know, you're tainted. And what does that do to a class of candidates? What does that do to, you know, existing leadership, you know, transformative leadership within the department? You know, where are they going to be looking to go? So it's tough.
Tara, how much does someone's identity as a woman or a person of color matter in the job of police chief?
I think it matters in any job, in any leadership, in any kind of, whether it's the president of the United States or if it's the police chief. And I mean, to see a woman of color in that top job has been fantastic for the past, as she served as Chief Best has served as an interim chief. I've been.
Why fantastic? Can you give me an example why it matters?
She was at, I believe, Mount Zion Church, and there was a standing ovation, and that was within days, I think, of her being interim chief. There is a lot of community support. There's a lot of proud moms and dads that can point to the kids that I know her. I've known her for the past 26 years. She has talked to this meeting. She has talked to me. You can be like her, or you can trust people like her. And I think that is huge.
Search Committee member Enrique Gonzalez, I know you have to go. Do you have time for any final words on the topic of what Seattle wants from its police chief?
Yeah, I will just say that the point that Tara just made about people feeling proud of having seen Carmen Best as leading the department, you know, while it's important for us as people of color to see people like us in positions of leadership, it's difficult to say that we'll ever be able to actually lead those places if when we apply for those, we're actually left out by the process itself and systemically X'd out. And so in terms of the chief selection process, I think we really need to look at holistically the hiring process of our city has to reflect the ability for people within its own ranks and within its city to elevate to those positions of leadership. If we always have to look outside, we're always going to be having this fight.
Enrique Gonzalez co-chairs the Community Police Commission, and he's a member of the Police Chief Search Committee. Enrique, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about Seattle's search for a new police chief, and the three finalists are Eddie Frizzell, an inspector at the Minneapolis Police Department, Cameron McClay, former Pittsburgh police chief, and Eli Reyes, assistant chief at the Austin Police Department. Eddie Frizzell and Eli Reyes are both people of color, since we were discussing that issue just a moment ago. We have a phone call from Annie, who's calling from, you're in Kent, Annie, but you have a story to tell or a question about what Seattle should look for in a police chief?
Well, I've just had a fantastic personal experience with something called peacemaking circles, which sounds very hippie 80s. The point is, it's a place where offender and victim and lawyers and judges can come together in a non-judgmental format to see everyone in the circle as an equal with a story. It's not just that the offender gets all fingers pointed at that person, but it's an equalizer. It's a place where community can happen, where maybe it hasn't so far.
In fact, we're going to be profiling the King County Peacemaking Circles in an upcoming interview on KUOW. So it sounds like, Annie, you would call for a Seattle police chief who's interested in will apply more restorative justice, as it's called?
It would be willing to look at the process firsthand and be supportive, as Chief Best has been. And we're sorry to see her go. But yes, somebody that would be willing to explore the process would be fabulous.
Thanks for calling, Annie.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
I was just going to add on to that, kind of that higher level of encouragement of transformative kind of relationships with police officers and community, and how we have seen that in LEAD. And I have been impressed.
Yeah, and this is a law enforcement
assisted diversion. Thank you for breaking down.
Yes, give us an example of how that works and why it matters.
So this matters hugely, because the initial design of the program was the officer could potentially arrest someone, run the record, and see that they have low level offenses and especially drug offenses, and say to that individual, "I could arrest you right now, but instead I want to take a chance on you, and I want to divert you into this program with this harm reduction approach. You don't have to do anything. You just meet with your case manager once and decide what's best for you." And for an individual who's probably interacted with an officer one time, 52 times, to see this officer make a different decision with that interaction is huge. And what has happened now is I will be in the police van. I've been there and I've heard the story and I didn't believe it, where those types of individuals are now coming to the police van, number one, to say, "Thank you, you've changed my life," or number two, "How can I get into this program that my friend got into?" So there is a huge trust in this relationship building. And I think that the police have invested in that even further in terms of their willingness to make greater changes. They were the ones that said, with this program, do we have to arrest an individual in order to get them in a program? Can we do a social contact referral instead? So they changed the program to be more open, and that was with them stepping in and taking risks. And the program is still growing, and that's because of the police and the chief being willing to take chances.
Tara Moss is project director at Seattle King County's Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program. We also have State Representative Morgan Irwin, who is a Republican from Enumclaw and is also a Seattle police officer who's not speaking on behalf of the police department today. Representative Irwin, people may have most recently seen you in a body cam video commandeering a jet ski to rescue two stranded kayakers. Speaking of body... Wow, by the way. How'd that turn out?
It was cold. It was
real
cold.
I bet. But also, body cam videos is a big issue. You're not speaking for the department, but I wonder how you feel about body cameras and the use of surveillance recordings and data in a Seattle police chief job.
Sure. So we've got some huge issues around specifically body cameras. Body cameras, I think, can be a fantastic tool in law enforcement. I like that I wear one. I'm incredibly frustrated and angered that, you know, in the manner that they were implemented. I mean, basically, former Mayor Ed Murray mandated that officers wear body cameras the day after it broke that his cousin was accusing him of, you know, sexual malfeasance. It was a naked attempt, it felt like, to kind of steal a media cycle. It wasn't negotiated. It broke with collective bargaining agreements in the state of Washington, and that's going to the courts. Right now, this week, we're in contract negotiations, which have lagged for over 3 years at this point. And I hope that those go well. And I think that people are negotiating in good faith, which is fantastic. And that's, again, kind of separate from the chief side. But when you think about body cameras, there's a lot of tough questions to ask. How is the data going to be stored? How can we make sure it's, you know, kind of hack-proof or as close to that as we can get to in this world? How can we respect people's privacy? When faces and crowds are picked up, I mean, we don't really want body cameras at like a normal peaceful protest where everyone's face is being recorded. That's not what we're trying to do. People don't really want body camera footage of, you know, the inside of their homes. Like if I'm inside your home because you were broken into and you're not doing anything that's embarrassing, but now I'm going to videotape, you know, in 1080i the entirety of the inside of your home while I search for evidence. And that should, you know, people don't want that on the internet. And then, you know, you can go to extreme examples of like, a rape victim being interviewed or things like that, or people in really, really, really uncomfortable situations. So body cams are, I think, an incredible tool going forward, and it's great for accountability on both sides, where someone can say, hey, you did this, and we can play the video back right then and say, I didn't. So I like body cameras as a tool. There's many in law enforcement that disagree with me, but I think they're fantastic. The process in which they were implemented here in the city of Seattle is borderline unconscionable.
What do you want from your next police chief? We're asking you to tell us a story when you give us a call at 206-543-5869, 543-5869. We talked to Bob Scales, who was a compliance coordinator for the city under the consent decree, the Justice Department's ordered reform. He's now heads the police strategies in Bainbridge. And he said that chiefs' jobs around the country are mostly the same. They end up being cheerleaders for the department. We've got the best officers in the country. We have the best policy. How much of the chief's job is morale boosting?
I think some of it the member of the selection committee alluded to this, the accountability side of being able to tell the story of the police department, good and bad, and telling that in a voice and a manner that the community can hear. So if someone is just nakedly saying, hey, rah, rah, it's all about the police and I'm there, that I don't think that helps build trust. Mm-hmm. But if someone can tell a cohesive story of, we had an officer involved in something and, you know, actions were being taken and this is us upholding our promise to the community, or we had officers involved in something that was really heroic and they saved people, they went above and beyond, and we want to tell that story also. And that is part of the job of the chief, is to be this master communicator between the department and the society that they serve. But that's only one facet of the job. And I think here in Seattle, one of the things that we're still looking at is finishing off the compliance period and continue to do any sort of transformative leadership that people still feel needs to be done. So I think that simplifies it somewhat to say that it's just a cheerleader. I think being that master communicator is one of three or four major facets of the job, though.
Tara, you mentioned car prowls a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in Seattle are saying that what they want from a police department and therefore a police chief is less property crime, car prowls, sleeping in parks, used needles, car camping. What do you think a Seattle police chief needs to be when it comes to those complaints?
I think they need to be a voice of authority and reason. And I think that can be very difficult. We're in an interesting situation. We had law enforcement decades in the past who have been able to use a tool and do arrests and arrest their way. And they say now law enforcement, they did not arrest their way out of the problem or the situation. And they're very clear about that. So they have awoken to this in a lot of the police officers that I talk to. But now community members liked that theory, but now want police officers to go back to just fixing it quick. And you're asking police, a law enforcement department to change their ways while there's community pressure to revert back. They don't care about the cost it's going to cost society or the budget. They just want people jailed. They want things gone. They want things stopped. So the police now know that what could have been happening in the past is wrong. And they are working on different creative solutions to move forward. So they need to be able to reflect that to the community. And there's lots of data and information around that. And I think it's really, really important for the police chief to really be able to reflect that credibly to the community, because it's also really dangerous when the community doesn't feel like their voice is being heard. And I have seen that as well. That's one of my goals, is no matter where you're coming from in terms of, for example, low-level drug users, I can talk to a business and say, I understand why this is difficult for your business. Let's figure out some solutions on that.
And so you're saying Seattle needs what from a police chief regarding that?
The knowledge and expertise of the long-term goals and not necessarily the short-term successes.
Officer Irwin, Representative Irwin, what do you have to say about that?
You know, it's funny because we've got police chiefs coming in. So like Pittsburgh, one of the finalists is from Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's a city of 300,000 people, give or take. They have a murder rate in the 60s to 70s.
How does that compare with Seattle?
Seattle's about 700,000 people, 650,000, and we're in the low to mid 20s. So they have a murder rate in that city that's, you know, 6-7 times ours. Mm-hmm. and on a per capita basis. So in terms of fixing those big, like, violent crime problems that we worried about in the mid-90s, many of those problems are already fixed or, you know, at least going trending positively. They have been for 20 years. And one of the hardest things, I think, for a police chief to come into is a well-functioning department, because what do you do? How do you brand? Hmm. And again, it comes down to, you know, how can you communicate on behalf of the department and represent the community? And then what can you do to help, the interface, the everyday interface between officers and citizens or community members? Because that's ultimately what it always comes down to, is do you trust the guy that's driving down your street? And again, with this selection process where I think a lot of people feel like the community was ignored, I think it may this process may have made my job harder.
You're less trusted as you drive down the street.
Yeah, and I don't know that to be true, and I hope that doesn't bear out. But, you know, I think that there's a very real change. You know, if this was happening at the State Patrol, which I have some purview over in my legislative capacity, you know, I would be worried that the troopers out on the road, you know, with this, where we tried to bring the community in, and then and many pieces of the community feel like they were then ignored. A lot of that trust that, the State Patrol has fought so hard to build over the last years, I think it would erode a lot of that. And I think that there's parallels that we can see here in the city.
Morgan Irwin is a Seattle police officer and a Republican state lawmaker from Enumclaw. Again, he wasn't speaking on behalf of the police department today, just his own perspective as an officer and a legislator. Tara Moss is project director at Seattle King County's Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, which diverts low-level drug and prostitution offenders from the criminal justice system into help services. And we have all been discussing the search for Seattle's new police chief. There are three finalists, one from Minneapolis, one from Pittsburgh, one from Austin, Texas, and not Carmen Best, who is the interim police chief in Seattle. We'll all go forward together. Thank you both for this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your calls and listening to The Record. We are coming right back and help you learn about who is behind the Facebook ads that target you and your community when it comes to local politics. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. In November, Eli Sanders, editor of the Seattle Stranger, walked into the local offices of Facebook and Google and hand-delivered a letter requesting information on political ads targeting Washington residents. You know, Washington state law requires that information be made public. But Facebook and Google never disclosed how much campaigns were spending on political ads here locally. And now, Washington State's Attorney General is suing Facebook and Google. This is a case that could change what you know about the political ads that target you online. So here to explain is The Stranger's Eli Sanders. Welcome back, Eli.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, why didn't Facebook and Google release the information that you asked for politely in this hand-delivered letter?
That is a very good question. And 6 months later, I still don't have an answer. But now, at least, I have the Attorney General of Washington on my side and the side of the law and the side of the people's right to know this information.
Why do we need to know more about political ads on Facebook and Google?
Because currently, we do not know enough. And in some cases, we don't know anything.
Can you give us an example? Like, what's an ad I might see and what don't I know and I want to know?
Sure. Let me start in a different realm. Let's start with radio. If I walk into KUOW, where I am right now, and say I'd like information on someone who has paid for a political ad targeting a Seattle election, I can get it right now. I can do that at King 5. I can do that at Como or Cairo TV. I can do it at local television stations, obviously, and newspapers. I can do that at the Seattle Times. In fact, in my reporting, I have done that to check on the funder of a certain political ad. So we think that's important to be able to do. We think disclosure in political ads is important so that you can know who is paying for this message that is trying to influence me. It's a way of being able to think more critically about the information that you're being given, and that's important to democracy. We need an informed public. If you're not aware of the source of your information, you're not well informed.
Okay. So I'm on Facebook or Google, and what's the ad I see, and what do I want to know and deserve to know about that ad?
Well, let's take the Seattle head tax fight, because right now there are ads on Facebook that have been running about the head tax and the campaign to get a referendum to repeal the head tax. That's obviously a really contentious issue. People have a lot of things to say about it, and there are people with agendas who might want to mislead you about it or rile you up in a misleading way. And so if you saw an ad on Facebook about the Seattle head tax, you would want to be able to know, who is this ad targeting? Who exactly is paying for this ad? And you would want to know how much they're paying. How many people exactly have seen this ad? And right now, even with Facebook's new political ad archive that they rolled out in May in response to criticism nationally of their lack of transparency in political advertising, even with Facebook's new political ad archive, you don't get all of that information that I've described. And all of that information, they are required by state law to disclose.
Do you know of a Facebook or Google ad, a pro or con about the Seattle employee head tax that is either misleading or designed to rile me up, as you say?
I don't have one right now that I can throw out in front of you, but if you want an example of misleading ads on Facebook that affected an election, take the U.S. presidential election of 2016. That's why we're talking about this. That's why I walked into Facebook and Google's offices in Seattle in November and December of 2017. Like a lot of Americans, I was still sitting here kind of stewing about what had happened. I was hearing about the Russian manipulation of our democracy and of our elections. And I was worried about the fact that a country, a foreign country, was able to buy political ads, target them at Americans over social media, and not have to disclose anything about that. And so then I learned about the existence of the laws here in Washington State, and I walked into those companies with the law in hand and said, hey, I'd like you to start disclosing information about just local ads. It was a way of testing and trying to enforce compliance. And they didn't comply. And now here we are with the Attorney General suing them. But there's no lack of examples of why it's a bad thing for social media political ads to not be labeled as ads and to not have their funders and targeting information disclosed.
I'd rather know more, right? If you're telling me, hey, do you want to know more or less? I'd say more. But give me an example of why it matters that there could be misleading or riling up ads regarding the Seattle in the local example,
sure.
Head tax. Why does that matter?
Let's go back to the Seattle head tax, and I'm talking about a not very far-fetched hypothetical here. I don't have these actual ads in front of me, but let's say that as we have seen in issues and debates around the country, people in the head tax debate are trapped in their filter bubbles. They're just experiencing a reality and an information download that they get from their Facebook news feed, right? And someone on the repeal the head tax side has said, okay, I've realized that really white men in North Seattle who own a home and have kids and have lived in Seattle for three decades are my target audience if I want to get people upset about the head tax. And I'm going to aim an ad on Facebook, which you can do, just at them. And I'm going to tell them that the head tax is a tax on their personal income, right? Or I'm going to suggest it, mm-hmm. which is not true, mm-hmm. but is out there being suggested sometimes by the head tax proponents, right? And the signature gatherers. We've reported on that at The Stranger. So there's a misleading ad, right? Mm-hmm. And it's targeted just at white men in North Seattle who fit some other demographic criteria. And I live in South Seattle. And I want to know, you know, that someone is trying to influence a debate in my city with this misleading ad. How would I know that ad exists if I wasn't able to go to Facebook and say, show me all the ads, not just the ads that are targeted me living in South Seattle, being, you know, a 40-year-old journalist, but targeted at everyone in whatever, you know, section or zip code of the city.
And a pro head tax group might target an ad at somebody very different, implying that Amazon pays no taxes
right.
in this city.
Right, yeah. Which is not true. They do pay some taxes.
Yeah. Okay. So as you suggested, Facebook and Google, Facebook, I know, has said that they have this new tool that they are helping you. They are committed to transparency. There's paid for by labels on political issued ads. There's a searchable archive of ads that tell you how much money was spent on an ad, how many people saw it, broad demographic information about the audience. Is that what you want?
It is a start. Now, let's be clear that the Facebook political ad archive just launched in May, and it is only for political ads from May of 2018 going forward. So that's a good thing, but it's a response to a bad thing, which was the total absence of a political ad archive, or what we would call in other media realms a public file, where you can go and see all the political ads. And what the Attorney General is suing Facebook for and suing Google for, and Google, by the way, completely lacks a political ad archive, but what he's suing them for is the failure to disclose ads going back to 2008. So this is a decade of failing to comply with Washington State's really forward-thinking election law, which has been on the books since the 1970s, and if these companies had cared to notice, they would have known that. And
a more stringent law than federal law?
It is.
So that's why it matters to have a local case that, in other words, they could be forced to comply with a more stringent local law than they would have to if people
yes.
like, if Washington State weren't suing them?
Yes. Let me clarify a few things. Local elections are regulated by local authorities. So mm-hmm. this law in Washington State will not affect, say, ads for Congress,
right.
even in Washington State.
Right.
But yes, at the federal level, you might have heard about the Honest Ads Act, right? This is Congress's attempt to do something about the Russian interference and to make political ads on Facebook more transparent in federal elections. Guess where that's gone? Nowhere. Mm-hmm. Congress has done nothing about the Russian interference in the last presidential election as we barrel toward the midterms. The Honest Ads Act is completely stalled and not going to be passed anytime soon that I know of.
Okay.
So yeah, here in Washington State, we do have a law that, because it was forward-thinking and written in a very smart way, applies now to mediums that didn't exist when it was written.
Yeah.
It applies to the digital space.
And those Russian ads got Eli Sanders interested in finding out how transparent we can make Facebook and Google, and he ended up in the local office of those companies. And now Washington State's Attorney General is suing Facebook and Google and says they are out of compliance with Seattle and Washington State's forward-thinking transparency laws when it comes to political ads. Eli Sanders, editor of The Stranger, thanks a lot for telling us the story. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Bob Ferguson's got a lot of lawsuits.
He does, but he seems to be able to juggle a lot all at once.
Indeed. Eli, thank you.
Thank you.
More of The Record coming up in a moment. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke with another story about a changing American institution. Your ideal. The Miss America organization announced today we are changing out of our swimsuits and into a whole new era. Here is the chair of the Miss America Board of Directors, former TV journalist and anchor Gretchen Carlson, telling Good Morning America that competitors will no longer be judged on their looks.
We want to be open, transparent, inclusive to women who may not have felt comfortable participating in our program before. But look, we have always had talent and scholarship, and we need to message that part of the program better as well. But now we're adding in this new caveat that we're not going to judge you on your outward appearance because we're interested in what makes you you.
So what now? Will the dream of a million girls who are more than pretty still come true in Atlantic City, as the old song went? Can they still turn out to be the queen of femininity, even if they're not being judged anymore on how they look in a swimsuit? Well, with us, we have two women who've been there. Christine Tedde was Miss Washington 2006. She's now a product manager with a tech company in Bellingham. Kristen, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks so much, Bill. I'm impressed you know so much of Bert's song.
Well, we do our research here in public radio. We also have Brittany Henry, Miss Washington 2011, who's now a health and wellness professional, a fitness teacher and blogger based in Los Angeles now. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So you both heard Gretchen Carlson say contestants will not be judged on their outward appearance. No more swimsuit competition, changes to the evening gown competition. Women can choose what they're comfortable in. I just want to hear your reactions first. Brittany, what was your reaction?
Well, of course, it was a surprise this morning. And, you know, I'm the first to say that there are going to be incredible positive outcomes that will come from this decision for women across our entire organization. And at the same time, I felt a little bit of a loss this morning. As a former contestant, I can tell you that there's never been a time in my life that I felt more empowered and strong than I did standing on the Miss America stage after working extremely hard to make my body stronger than it's ever been before. And I found in that moment that competition to be nothing but positive, a celebration of my work, what I'd done for my body, my health. And with this announcement, I think the organization and the new leadership have really great intentions and plans for this organization. I'm also sad that this piece of competition couldn't be included. And, you know, it's surprising, but I'm feeling a little sad about it.
Brittany, before I go to Kristen, I just want to know, what do you say to the many, many women who were not standing on that stage, who don't feel empowered or strong by the fact that the swimsuit, et cetera, is the standard by which they are so often judged?
Absolutely. And I can acknowledge that women at home in the audience could feel disempowered from watching this at home. But right now in our climate, this is all about empowering women on our individual and together level. And lifestyle and fitness competition, specifically with Miss America, has been very misunderstood for decades. I think that it's really important that we work on clarifying what this competition has meant and kind of getting rid of some of the misnomers about it.
So how is it misunderstood?
The portion is based on physical fitness and health, similarly to other fitness competitions that you would see outside of pageantry. We train similarly to bodybuilders, athletes. We spend a lot of time in the gym. We work on nutrition. This has been a portion of competition that has been evolving over time since our foundation, our start in 1921. Even just between the years when Kristen and I competed, it had evolved a lot during that portion. So I think people have this idea that there is a judge of misogynistic white men sitting there as these young women come out in string bikinis getting judged on how sexy or how pretty they are. And from my perspective as a contestant, that was never, ever, ever how it was. This portion of competition made me feel incredibly empowered and was all about my personal health and fitness journey, which is still, as you mentioned in my introduction, something that I'm very passionate about today.
Yes, that's your really, profession.
Yes, yeah. It's really... I'd like to add just quickly that I grew up in the Seattle area in under the poverty line. And as we know, people living under the poverty line have less access to nutritional options, health and wellness education, and that was very much the case for me. So as a 19-year-old looking for scholarship opportunities for college, the Miss America organization was really my first introduction into what health and wellness looks like and what it means. It was my first time mm-hmm. going to the gym and eating vegetables instead of cereal for breakfast. So mm-hmm. for me, it was such a positive thing okay. and has meant so much to me, which is why I've carried it on to the other parts of my life.
Brittany Henry, Miss Washington 2011. Also with us, Christine Tedde was Miss Washington 2006. And Kristen, what was your reaction to the change that, according to Gretchen Carlson, that the Miss America, it's not a pageant, it's a competition, and you won't be judged mm-hmm. on your looks?
Mm-hmm. Well, my reaction this morning was, okay, it's time for that. We have seen over the years, I mean, Miss America is 97 years old. It's an iconic American tradition. And over the years, many state title holders and Miss Americas have talked about the relevance of the swimsuit competition and the swimsuit portion. And Brittany eloquently outlined why we all competed in swimsuit and we're on board with it because it requires, the job is grueling. I mean, I made 100 Rotary Club speaking appearances during my year. I lobbied Congress. I traveled overseas to represent different cities in Washington State. It's a grueling year, and you have to have the stamina to withstand that. But there are so many other ways to demonstrate that. And I can think of so many young women who today feel like the door has been opened for them to compete for Miss America. And these are young women who have never felt like they had access to it before. So I'm somebody who loves to think about equality and equal opportunity. Well, today is that day for
Kristen,
any young woman who's listening. Please compete at your local pageant Miss America.
And you say any young woman. In a very informal canvassing of colleagues, very few people believe that Miss America competitors will not still be judged in some way on their mm-hmm. looks. Do you really mm-hmm. think that that's a thing of the past, that Miss America will have nothing to do with conventional beauty standards?
Oh, that's it. Oof. How much time do we have, Bill? that's a pretty
3 minutes,
deep
in fact.
Conversation. Oh, 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I think that I'd love to believe that won't be the case, that people will only be judged by what they say, by what their goals are, what their aspirations are, and what they've accomplished. And you and I both know we live in a society where first impressions are very important, and appearance is part of that. And so I think that Miss America today is setting a vision for the future. Miss America, in fact, is putting this incredible stake in the ground saying, this is what we're moving toward. And at this time, I think there could be no better signal of what we want our society to be for women and for empowering women. I mean, I watched Brittany compete at Miss America and during her time as Miss Washington, and what a remarkable representative she was for this state. And I think the same could be said for all of the Miss Washingtons who competed at Miss America. And so Miss America needs to have a vision for the future. The organization does. And I line up right behind this one and say, okay, it's time. Let's do this. And also, I think this puts down the gauntlet for the public. You've been saying for years that you think the swimsuit portion is antiquated. It's incongruent with the image of Miss America as scholar. So watch Miss America and prove that you agree with what you said.
Right. See how many people. And that's an open question. What will the ad funders, the sponsors think? Mm-hmm. What will people watch this competition? Brittany, in a way, the old 100-year-old swimsuit competition in Atlantic City was antiquated, but it was clear. Now it's not swimsuit. It's not evening gown, but I suppose you could wear whatever you want, but there's still a talent competition. But what does that have to do with scholarship and good works in the community? It's unclear. And what do you think of that question? Are looks really having nothing to do with Miss America anymore?
You know, I agree a lot with Kristen. She made some wonderful points. What I'd like to touch on is that the elimination of this piece of competition, as it stands right now, means the elimination of health and fitness component at Miss America. So in our current climate, where we are, as women, are feeling more liberated than ever before, free to do what we want with our own bodies, I hope that the Miss America organization and leadership finds a way to incorporate health and fitness and almost reclaim those negative stereotypes that have for a long time surrounded our swimsuit competition and turn it into something positive that we can all get behind together. And I'd like to quickly add, as Kristen mentioned, if you are a woman listening to this right now and you feel like this is a triumph, I hope that you tune into the next pageant and give these women your support and help us usher into the new generation of Miss America 2.0.
Right. It'll be up to you, the listening public, the viewing public. You've been listening to Brittany Henry, Miss Washington 2011, now a health and wellness professional, fitness teacher, and Kristen Tedde, Miss Washington 2006, now a product manager with a tech company in Bellingham. We're reflecting on the changes to Miss America announced today. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
It's The Record. Produced by Amina Alsadi today and Allison Bruzek and Ajua Jima Brenpong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, Pamela Druckerman's new book is There Are No Grown-Ups, a Midlife Coming-of-Age Story. Join us then.